So welcome again to day two, where we like to discuss how Australian actuaries are making a difference. Now it might sound a little perverse, but we're going to actually start by seeking some views of some prominent non-actuaries on the broader social issues that this country is facing. So this morning we're attempting to really open your minds up to the broader social issues that actuaries may or may not have an opportunity to influence. So I'm looking forward to the session with two very distinguished guests. Similar format to yesterday, although you can do the calculations more quickly than me, with two presenters, each of about 30 minutes, which should leave around 25, 30 minutes for discussion time at the end. And again, we'd love your input for that. So our first speaker is exceptionally well-credentialed for this session. Bernard Salt is a partner at KPMG, where he leads a team of demographic researchers. He works with both the private sector and the public sector to help people understand how social, cultural, and demographic change might shape the future business environment. Bernard is a master of diverse communication media, best-selling author of three books, regular social commentator on radio and TV, and a popular public speaker. Please welcome Bernard Salt.
Thanks very much, Martin, for that introduction, and thanks also to the Institute for the invitation to speak. Bernard Salt, I'm a partner with KPMG based in Melbourne. My presentation this morning, the implications of social change during the 2010s. I have a very simple proposition, and that proposition is that the Australia you will have known over the last decade will change quite profoundly over the next decade. Generational, social, cultural change, and importantly, ethnic shifts is going to change the nature of the Australian community and find its way through in a series of implications for business and society, perhaps even for the politics of Australia. I want to start by asking a really big picture question. What has the Australian nation done with the Australian continent in the last quarter of the 20th century? And this map, I've identified areas of extreme population growth and extreme population loss between 1986 and 2009. What is that? 23 years, 24 years. The last of a century, and it shows areas of extreme growth and population loss. There are 78 red bits on this map. These are places where there has been population loss of 1% or more each and every year for 25 consecutive years. As a nation, as a generation, we are saying we don't live in the red bits, we live in the blue bits, and the blue bits are on the coast. Where there has been population growth of 2% or more each and every year for 25 consecutive years. This goes to the heart of my argument of a fundamental shift in the settlement of the Australian continent. Previous generations of Australians settled the margins of the outback. Now one farmer buys out the neighbour. The neighbour then moves to the nearest big city or, in fact, to the coast. The only blue bit in inland Australia is this bit in outback South Australia, which is, in fact, the Woomera Detention Centre, so I wouldn't get too excited about the... It says it all, this map, in terms of our aspirations and our current political situation. But again, this is my point in terms of where business opportunity has been and will be. The Australian nation very much focused on lifestyle shifts to the edge of the Australian continent. The other shift that I think is profoundly shaping the Australian nation at the moment is a fundamental change in the ethnic composition of the Australian population. In this chart, I identify the top five fastest growing tribes in Australia over the last decade. And by tribes, I mean non-Australian born populations. As a fact, over the 10 years to 2009, there were 220 odd thousand extra people arrived on the Australian continent as permanent settlements who had been born in India. These figures are about 2 years old. That figure's probably now at about 300,000 or so, just over the last 10 years or so. The Chinese are here in big numbers, as are the New Zealanders, South Africans. In fact, there are over 500,000 New Zealanders living in Australia. There's only 800,000 on the South Island of New Zealand, and this number is growing more rapidly. But when you stand back from this and look at the big picture trends, the way I view this is Asian Anglo influences on the Australian population. This is very different to the Anglo-Mediterranean influences that we saw in the late 20th century, the Greeks and the Italians. When the Greeks and the Italians arrived here in the 1950s, we regarded their food as wog food, and we said as much. By the 1980s, we realised, actually, your food is better than our food. And by the 1990s, we started to emulate their lifestyle, eating out on the pavement as they do the piazza, the plaza. You had this cultural fusion that took place over 30 years or so. The opportunity in business is not in selling product or understanding necessarily the demographics of a particular ethnic group. It's the way in which that ethnic group might impact by osmosis the culture, the values, the palate, the preferences of mainstream Australia. Anglo-Australians used to drink tea, black tea, up until the mid-1970s. Then when the Mediterraneans arrived, after 30 years, there was a palate shift. We started to drink coffee. The Asians drink tea. Will there be a palate shift again by the end of the 2010s as a consequence of this change. I live in Melbourne's eastern suburbs. Our local Woolworths store, Safeway store, closed in 1998 for renovations. When I went into that store 2 weeks later and into the fruit and vegetable department, I saw something that I had never seen before. An entire bay was given over to bok choy. I had never seen bok choy before. Of course, it is used in Vietnamese cooking. The Vietnamese had arrived in Melbourne less than a decade earlier, and within 10 years, they had shifted the mainstream palate and preferences of the Australian population to the extent that a mainstream supermarket was now carrying bok choy. And of course, since then, you have choy sum, pak choy, bok choy. There's an entire family of choys that has arrived over the last decade. And again, it's a way in which these influences start to shape mainstream thinking. And you think, well, how could the Asian influence start to shape Australian mainstream thinking by the end of the decade, beyond the tea shift, perhaps? The Chinese, for example, believe in the principle of feng shui. This is the idea that you don't have the front door and the back door lined up because the energy goes straight through the house. Now, I'm not particularly persuaded one way or another about that issue, but if I want to sell my house and maximise my resale property value in, say, 5 or 6 years' time, then perhaps I will want to include Chinese buyers. As a consequence, you could find the entire housing industry shifting to reflect the principles of feng shui. When you look at it, the Chinese, the Indians, are different to the Mediterraneans, who came here largely as unskilled labour. The Chinese and the Indians are coming through the universities. The Chinese, particularly through the professions, the Indians as entrepreneurs. They will find their way through to middle-class prosperity very quickly, and they will want trophy property, education services, I suppose. And so they will actually express their impact or their preferences in a consumer society over the next 10 years. When you look at this, say, the New Zealanders and South Africans, they play rugby. If I was Andrew Demetrio running the AFL, I would be quite concerned about this. It's the way in which these influences not convert but fuse with the local population. They're the social changes that I would expect over the as these trends continue. The demographics that are going backwards over the last 10 years, the poor old Italians arrived here in the 1950s. 60 years later, of course, they're dying off. The recession of Mediterranean values, the advance of Asian values, cultures, preferences, palate, if you like. There was a design shift, for example, in Australian housing in the middle of the 1990s. In came that edgy, minimalist architectural look. In fact, this building has been made over in that style. I think it is quite a Milan-esque, Italian, cosmopolitan, continental look, if you like. I don't think that design shift would have gained the purchase in Australia had there not been 30 or 40 years of Mediterranean migration. what will Australia look like in 2020? Not just in terms of the demographic composition, but the way in which the new influences start to shape, impact, influence, by osmosis, mainstream Australian culture and values. In the next chart, I actually wanted to look at the way in which the different life segments have evolved in Australia over the last 80 years. And in order to do this, I've gone back to 1931 to look at life expectancy in Australia at that time. The average life expectancy in 1931 was 63 years. You qualified for the age pension at 65, so you promptly dropped dead 2 years before you got a pension back in 1931. The other thing to note is that in 1931, you're a child for 14 years, and then you're an adult. The life form we now know as the teenager did not exist in 1931. Childhood, adulthood, old age, and death. That's the way it worked 80 years ago, and you're an old person at 51 or 52. When you get home from the conference, get out your family photograph albums. Have a look at pictures of your grandparents at the age of 50. They were old people. They looked old. They dressed old. They knew they had about 10 years to go. Let's kick it forward to another 40 years. By 1971, life expectancy kicked out to 71 years. That is 6 years in retirement. And has to be planned for, provision for. No need for our grandparents to save for retirement because they knew they were going to drop dead in the workplace. Whereas by 1971, you've got 6 years of retirement that has to be funded either by the individual or by the state. The other thing that's happened by 1971 is that the baby boomers have come along. They've invented a transition phase between childhood and adulthood, 13 to 19, the teenage phase in life. By 2011, of course, average Australian has kicked out to 82 years, 83 for women and 79 for men. That is 17 years in retirement that now has to be planned for, provision for, although the most common age at retirement for an Australian is not 65, it is 58. That is 24 years in retirement. Statistically, if you make it through to 58, you've got more than 24 years, you've got about 27 years in retirement. Let's just say the last couple of years ain't so hot. You've got about 20 healthy, active years of life that has been gifted to this generation. What are you going to do? Sit at home and babysit the grandkids, or are you going to re-engineer that space? And that is exactly what I think baby boomers will do over the 2010s. They will work on beyond 60, beyond 65, partly because they have not invested enough to live in retirement in the manner to which they've become accustomed. Work 5 days, then 4 days, then 3 days, then 2 days, then 1 day per week. Blurring and blending work with lifestyle. Sea change, tree change is all part of that social movement of extending the working life. We are very happy as a society to pay you an age pension from the age of 65, but you've got to promise to drop dead 10 years later. And we haven't been keeping our side of the bargain. As you extend life expectancy in this direction, these are very, very expensive years of life to maintain. And we simply cannot, you have not paid enough tax between 20 and 60 to justify the extra years of life that we now expend, 25, 30 years, and every one of those really expensive years for society to maintain. There is no other conclusion that you can come to other than during the 2010s, life expectancy and the working life will extend beyond 60, perhaps even beyond 70 in due course. There is evidence of a generation reaching in and re-engineering a decade. Over the last decade, Gen X and Gen Y have picked up the teenage phase in life invented by the baby boomers. They have picked it up and they've stretched it. I think you're now a teenager between the ages of 13 and 29. All of the measures of the transition into adulthood that baby boomers are making at 21, 22, 23, commitment to marriage, mortgage, children and a career, has been kicked out by Generation X and now by Generation Y to 28, 29 or 30. That immediately changes the use of discretionary time and spending in the 20-something time in life. If you're not committed to marriage, mortgage, children and a career, you do not need to be in a three-bedroom brick veneer on the edge of town. You need to be in an inner-city apartment where you can form, dismantle and reform relationships before you make your final selection, just on the right side of 30. There has been a shift in the narrative of how you live your 20s over the last decade. And a key indicator behind this is the average age at first marriage. In 1971, the average age at first marriage for an Australian woman was 21. She was a baby boomer born in 1950. She would have announced her engagement on her 21st birthday. Otherwise, she thought she was going to be on the shelf. Whereas today, the average age at first marriage for an Australian woman is 29. 8 years has opened up. Cafes, bars, restaurants, out with suburbia, in with apartmentia, gap years, work overseas, come back, live with mum and dad. And in fact, if you were to today announce your engagement on your 21st birthday, you would be regarded as a loser. You should have completed tertiary education, paid off HECS, travelled overseas, established and developed a career, trialled, even road-tested relationships, then commit to marriage and mortgage at 28 or 29. There has been a shift in thinking, in how you actually live your life in that decade. I think over the next decade, baby boomers will pick up that teenage phase in life as a transition phase. They'll pick it up and they will reinsert it into that 50-something time in life as a transition phase. Peak income earning capacity in your late 40s, and then you transition. The hard edges of the 20th century have been left behind. You used to get the keys to the door at 21. You were an adult at 21. Speak to Gen X, Gen Y. They don't feel they are ready to take on full commitments until 28, 29 or 30. These people live at home with their parents well into their 20s. They're known as kippers, K-I-P-P-E-R-S, kids in parents' pockets, eroding retirement savings. That's the kipper effect. And of course, life expectancy pushes out. Traditional retirement still there, 65 to 74, and the frail elderly from 75 and beyond. Although, in speaking to the assisted care industry, they tell me that the kick-in is not 75, it's 78. It is literally 20 years of life, 58 to 78, that I think is going to be re-engineered, starting over the coming decade. A powerful social shift that we'll see in the next decade. In the next slide, I actually wanted to look at the way in which income had changed in society. And in order to do this, I've gone back to the last census to look at the average income per person by single year of life from 15 through to the age of 100. This is unpublished data. It is actually, there's a new census in August of this year. We will not get the results until August of next year. But these figures don't really change that much from one census to another. And this is, 15 million Australian income earners, including pensioners. And you see, this is the average income per person across Australia. From 15 right up through 20s, you should be on the up. Right throughout your 30s, you should be on the up. And it reaches a peak between 45 and 49. If you are on the left-hand side of 45, you've got good things to look forward to. If you're on the right-hand side of 49, then statistically it is downhill all the way. Your 50s, 60s, down here to 70. At the age of 70, the age pension fully kicks in and it flatlines, bubbles along through 70, 80 up to 90, 92, 93. And then at the age of 96, 97, 98, something quite extraordinary happens. It suddenly shoots back upwards. Now, there's two possible explanations for this. Either death takes poor people first, just leaving rich old people, or by the time you get to 96, you completely lose it. When you fill out the census form, you think you're really rich. It is, in fact, a very small sample size. This is a statistical aberration. There is nothing to look forward to at 96. I actually divide the life cycle into four quarters. So the first 20 years, you're a kid. The next one is about household formation. And you see the type of products that it's in this fourth quarter in life, third quarter in life, where you are at the peak of your income earning. You should be saving, investing in superannuation so that you can draw down in that fourth and final quarter in life. Anything beyond 80, I'm considering to be a bonus. I was quite taken with this chart. This is 2006 figures, and I can update it in a year's time. I was so taken with it that I went back to the 1986 census and got the unpublished data. Same chart, different scale on the left, but here is how the 1986 data went. It went something like this. Up to a peak at 39 and down at 44. The point is that there has been a distortion in wealth generation or income earning capacity in Australia over the last 20, 25 years, a distortion in this direction and that is the social shift of women remaining in the workplace. They are not getting married at 21. Average age at first confinement 40 years ago was at the age of 23. Cafes, bars, restaurants, gap years, working overseas, careers, if you like, has generated an extraordinary amount of consumer spending into this time in life. This is before you have kids, about 25 through to 32, peak income earning capacity. And if you look at the way society has changed with the cafes, the bars, the restaurants, the spending on electronics, the shift from apartmentia to suburbia, have a look at motor vehicles, Honda Jazz, Ford Festiva, Toyota Echo, VW Polo. Motor vehicles designed, marketed, price-pointed and pitched at single professional women in their 20s in a market that did not exist a generation ago, all underpinned by this distortion. The other point is that in 1986, it peaked at 39 through to 44. If you're not getting married and having kids until 28, 29 or 30, you cannot peak in your income earning capacity at 39. The income earning capacity peak has got to push out. It's now, or was, 44 to 49. I would think at the moment that it's probably, say, 48 through to about 53, and it will continue to push in this direction. It raises the question that over the 2010s, where will be the distortion in income earning capacity? And if we've seen this has been the shift in the last 30 years, the next 30 years, beginning in the 2010s, I think will be here, as baby boomers remain in the workplace, working 5 days, 4 days, 3 days, 2 days, 1 day per week. There'll be more spending capacity in the 55 to 65 demographic, that demographic that has been treated as a wasteland by business, by advertisers, I think will start to blossom going forward. Baby boomers will have more money to spend over the next decade. And then you would start to see consumer product shift and contort around that level of spending. Just finally, I want to talk about the way in which the global financial crisis, I think, has shaped consumer spending in Australia. For 10 years leading up to the GFC, I think there was a particular mindset that drove consumer behaviour. And in fact, this was an era of high consumerism, of corporate high flyers, a culture of live for the moment, a culture of total confidence in the future. If you have total confidence in the future, you can live in a sliver of time called the present. Max out about tomorrow because tomorrow is always better than today. You can live right on the edge. Plasma televisions, McMansions, Marlowe Blahnik shoes, made famous by the girls of Sex and the City. What do they cost? $1,000 a pair? You spend $1,000 on a pair of shoes today and you're seen as being frivolous. There are people out there losing their jobs. Easy credit, rising house prices. During a boom, it's all about me. I'm on fire. I'm doing well. Sell me an apartment in number 1 Kent Street. Sell me an apartment in the Melburnian. Sell me an apartment at number 1 Kangaroo Point. Trophy property, trophy consumption, aspirational consumption. Celebrate my success, the individual success. Australian Idol, celebrity chef culture, all came out of the boom, celebrating the individual. And then I think it all ended. It all turned in that final quarter in 2008, and a new paradigm, a new wave of consumer spending emerged at that time. What I think has emerged since that time is what I would call the rise of the new moral consumer. What Melburnians would call a new wowserism, a new conservatism. We have sinned mightily in the past and now it is time to repent, to pay back debt, to live sustainably, to live frugally. And you can see a whole series of new taboos emerge out of nowhere or gain currency, if you like. Anti-smoking, drinking, speeding, gambling, corporate excess, and the newest taboo is obesity. I was actually speaking on this subject to a group of politicians recently, and I made the point that when society galvanises behind a set of beliefs, it represents taxation opportunities. And you should have seen their eyes light up. When you think, there is a moral imperative behind each one of these arguments, behind every one of these taxes. I think in the 2010s, a junk food tax, all argued on the basis of a new morality. And when you think about all of those taxes, and even the green, the carbon tax, there is a moral argument behind it. We have sinned, and now it is time to atone for that sinning in the past. That's the mindset that underpins the modern consumer. I also think that the market for global celebrities is underpinned by this thinking. What global celebrity can you think of over the last 10 years that has encapsulated the values of the boom? Mindless consumerism, materialism, don't worry about tomorrow, just live in the moment. There is only one. Come here. Paris Hilton, absolutely brilliant. Very clever lady, brilliant product, absolutely perfectly pitched for the zeitgeist of the time. The right product at the right time. If my assessment is correct and there's been a shift in values, then Paris's star would fade during the downturn. Wrong product for the wrong time. What we need is a new global celebrity to come out of nowhere to encapsulate the values of the downturn. True value, real value, hidden value, secret value, realised value. And the person that I'm thinking of is that Scottish lady that almost won Britain's Got Talent, Susan Boyle. When she appeared on television in February 2009, 5 months after Lehman Brothers, she generated 130 million YouTube hits across the globe. Why did she connect at that time? And I think it was because when she walked on stage, we viewed her through the lens of the boom, preparing to judge her outwardly, superficially, if you like. And then we heard her sing, and then there was this awful, gut-wrenching recalibration. We shouldn't be viewing her that way, we should be viewing her that way. And to me, it symbolised the shift in thinking. I actually see Susan Boyle and Paris Hilton on the same scale. Paris is at one end, Susan is at the other. Susan Boyle is everything that Paris Hilton is not. She's plain, she's middle-aged, she's talented. And that is my point. All of a sudden, we see true value, real value. If during a boom, it's all about me, I'm on fire, I'm doing well, during a downturn, it is fear, retreat to the home, the herd, the family, the tribe, the community. How many times have you heard the word community used in the last 2 years or so? It is fear. Perhaps the retreat to big brand is also important. It raises the question, well, if we've been chastened by the downturn, so 2.5 years ago, how long does this last? Is it permanent? Is it going to colour consumer behaviour and sentiment forever? Well, interestingly, if you speak to someone who went through the Great Depression 80 years later, they will still talk about that. Don't take on debt. Pay everything for cash. I think it was a scarring effect that shaped a generation for the rest of their lives. And there was after the 1991-1992 recession, global recession, there was an American trend forecaster who came up with a brilliant idea or assessment that after the recession or the excesses of the 80s, we would cocoon. The whole concept of cocooning emerged, and we would retreat to the home and invest in home furnishing, home education, home decoration, home entertainment, if you like. And that is exactly what happened in the US and in Australia in 1992, 3, 4, 5. By 6, 7, 8, 9, we're into the tech boom. So the impact, if you like, after the last recession, I think was about 4 or 5 years. We're at the 2.5 year mark at the moment. The point is that these things move in waves, and sooner or later, maybe 2012, 13, 14, will move into another wave. Consumer behaviour, I think, is still recoiling from the impact of the GFC and will continue to do so through 2011, maybe 2012. But by 13, 14, 15, if you look at the evidence of the last recession, I think then we'll see a shift in consumer sentiment and consumer behaviour. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bernard. Looking forward to exploring a wide range of those topics.